Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget the bug spray as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
All right. This is Monsteropolis, a show about anomalies, legends, and monsters. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined, as always, by my pal, Mark Matzke.
Hey, greetings from the old school setup of podcastery.
Yeah.
Talking through phones and devices and so forth. I had really gotten used to the old, or the new, coming in face-to-face setup. That was the new normal, and now we're back here.
Yeah, doing this. It's okay. Maybe things will turn. Maybe we'll be together again. It's funny. I was looking at a picture. I was looking through something. It must have been my phone, and it was a picture of you holding Tommy here at the office. And I was like, man, that seems like years ago. And it was like 6 weeks ago.
Yep, I know the one you're talking about.
Yeah, that's crazy. Let me think. Did we get emails? I should have looked at this stuff before we went live.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't recall any being forwarded my way, but.
Yeah. I'm not seeing any. Oh, you know what? We did get an email.
Okay.
It was from our buddy Andrew. And by now, I mean, by now, this is going to be pretty obvious, but Andrew Smith from the Flatwoods Monster Museum sent us an email. Hi, Seth and Mark. First time, long time. Not really. I bother you both all the time. Anyway, listening to the most recent episode of Monsteropolis, you all made a request for listener mail, and it just so happened to be the same day that we decided to close the Flatwoods Monster Museum located in Sutton, West Virginia to the public for the foreseeable future. Whether that is a week or whatever is deemed necessary to be determined at a later date. So if any of your listeners were considering a trip, they may want to postpone for the time being. That being said, check for updates on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you want to check for updates, we are at Flatwoods Monster Museum on all platforms. Thank you all for the show. I thoroughly enjoy listening every week, and the back catalog of Sasquatch has been great to dive into as well. Stay safe. P.S. I believe the Mothman Museum in Point Pleasant is closed as well. So the monsters have gone back into hiding. For the moment, anyway.
The world is theirs at this point.
Yeah.
Roam about freely.
Yes. Roam the countryside. someone told us to check out Thomas Seward if we do the Vancouver trip. Not Vancouver, but if we do the British Columbia trip still, which, I mean, it's still on my list because it's a big part of On the Trail of Bigfoot season two. Right. I mean, I don't think people understand I hear a lot of people that are like, well, I'm sure this will affect your roster for the year and stuff. And like the way we function, it can't, I mean, unless we want to go out of business. So, unless the lockdowns or whatever go into effect and stay in effect until like next year, every single project I have said is coming out this year is going to come out this year. Barring, you know, me dying or something like that. I probably shouldn't even joke about that, but,
or abduction.
Yeah. Abduction, alien abduction, Bigfoot abduction, anything of the sort. My ultimate goal here is to continue producing Small Town Monsters movies and the projects we have in the works. And actually I've been working on the Mothman legacy, even though it's not, our filming isn't done. I've just gone ahead and started tinkering with the timeline this week, actually. It's almost like creating a sort of like a moving storyboard. I'm using footage from past films and Shutterstock images and Pond5 stuff where I need it. And that way I'll at least have a decent blueprint for the movie sort of laid out. And it's been kind of fun. It's actually been really therapeutic because it's my work, you know, like I'm just able to dive back into what I do. I wish we had more of the movie, like the final movie shot, but I think at the same time, it's going to give me a whole new way of working on our stuff. We don't do things like this. We're much more seat of the pants than people probably realize. But I've been.
So you might have a clear idea of like specific shots and stuff that you want.
That's what I'm trying to do. Yeah. Because, you know, like it's funny you'd say that. I literally sat down this morning and wrote a shot list for like the opening, like the shot specific B-roll shots I want to open the movie, which I've never really done before. Not never done. We've definitely done that. Like Invasion on Chestnut Ridge was always supposed to be sort of a drone shot in the world flipping upside down and all that stuff. So there have been times where we've known going into it, but we're usually not this thorough going into something. And the other thing is, you know, I've got Santino already working on different effect shots. Did I send you the opening credits the other day?
No.
Oh, geez. I don't think so. Oh man. Gave me chills. I'm not kidding. Like,
wow.
Yeah. It gave me chills. I'll send it to you as soon as we're done here. His opening credits sequence for Mothman Legacy is great.
Wow.
And let me think, what else did I want to say here at the beginning? Oh, okay. So listeners obviously know now we've been adding additional shows that will continue for the foreseeable future until everything goes back to normal. And we might keep doing it after that. I don't know. It's been fun getting back to doing interviews. And we talked to Stan Gordon the other night. We talked to Adam Wingard, back to back, and both of those were really fun interviews. I'm not sure yet what we're doing with the Wingard interview. He realized after the interview was done, he may have said too much about Kong versus Godzilla. So we're waiting. He wants to come back on the show and do another episode too. That's much more focused on the paranormal. So,
yeah.
So we'll,
I feel at least partly responsible for that, but I couldn't help myself.
Yeah, no, you were good. So we'll get him. We'll definitely release that interview we already did. It's just probably going to be missing like 15 minutes or more. So we can put it out, but super cool to talk to him.
It was, and you and I both mentioned afterwards too, how, soothing it was to talk to Stan Gordon.
Yeah.
It was just very calming. It had a very nostalgic, good feeling to it. It was fun because you know what his area of expertise is and how fluent he is in communicating that. You just have to serve him up some good intro and let him go. And we could sit there and just kind of go back to normal for a few minutes. So it was nice.
It was escapism. Like, I don't know how else to put it, but for me, it was very much like escapism. And it got me thinking, just like looking forward to doing the stuff we do. You know, like you and I get to do we get to do Monstropolis together, but we don't, you know, people would probably be surprised. We don't spend a ton of time together throughout the year. You know, I think we see each other outside of Monstropolis, maybe once a month. And some of those trips, actually a large number of those trips tend to be over in that area, like near the Chestnut Ridge. So it just made me nostalgic for like Permane Brothers and hanging out. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. So, so once this is all over, I still want to do some sort of Monstropolis meetup and get everyone together somewhere here in Monstropolis.
Monstropolis. Capital City.
Yeah, and we've had responses from people that saying they'd love to come out for a live show. So
that'd be awesome.
We'll get something together and do it here in Wadsworth or somewhere around.
Yeah.
But we're continuing with our West Virginia month or West Virginia theme. I don't know how long this is going to go because I had other thoughts for things I'd like to do regarding West Virginia. But this week I think we're going to talk about sort of the folklore and even urban legend style stories focused on the state, the great state of West Virginia, one of my favorite states, a state I desperately miss right now.
Oh, yeah.
It's like Andrew sent me that message about Flatwoods. I adore Flatwoods and Sutton. Like you grow so attached to some of these places we go to, you know, like I miss Whitehall all the time. Think about it all the time. So we're talking about West Virginia, and just know that I will be sitting here dreaming about West Virginia while we're talking about it, because I love it.
Almost heaven.
Right. One of my grandpa's, my grandpa Schrock, one of his favorite songs was,
no kidding,
was that song. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Country Roads. Yeah. So, I have notes. You'd be surprised to learn that I have notes, that I took for this episode. And some of this, I can't act like I did it too much research. Some of this is also just because I've been doing some of this research for the Mothman Legacy. And some of what we're going to talk about, I think, will be, based around an interview, a couple interviews we already did for Mothman Legacy as well. So, Mark, can you start us off on, I don't know where we want to go or how we want to do this. I know I want to talk about, I mean, like, go ahead.
Sure. There's a couple, I mean, West Virginia folklore, there's so many different angles that we could take to get started on it. But I found this one phrase from an author named Richard Dorson. Mm-hmm. He called the Appalachian region and West Virginia in particular folklore's natural habitat, which I just love that phrase.
Yeah.
I think that's so cool. And part of the reason for that, of course, is the story of various immigrant groups that came into West Virginia in order, you know, essentially searching for a better life and the American dream and so forth, and the promise of leaving a pretty hard scrabble existence in Western Europe or even Central Europe, and coming to the New World with the promise that if you come over and have a good work ethic, one of the major attractions, I guess, was the fact that there's the promise of land. Mm. You know, it's not a lot of it was an income, of course, but as much of that, people were attracted to the idea that they could become landowners as opposed to some of the situations that they were fleeing in Europe. You've got a couple things going on with immigrant groups, but the one I think that we wanted to concentrate on a little bit was the Celtic groups. There's a author by the name of David Fisher who came up with, after he analyzed the situation, his whole argument developed on the fact that he thought there were a huge group that after the year 1717, there was a giant group of immigrants from Northern Britain who came over and settled in Appalachia and West Virginia. And they were from the borderlands of North Britain. So near Scotland and Ireland and so forth. And all these people were really used to instability and just everyday strife. There's lots of borderland skirmishes and just not a whole lot to live off.
Right.
So they aspired to small independent land ownership. That was something that really mattered a lot to them. So in the 18th century, you have these immigrants driven by poverty and population pressure and dreaming of having their own land to own, came over and started to, you know, find work in factories, mills, and in the case of West Virginia, especially mines. And once they got here, I think some of them realized that the American dream wasn't necessarily what they had and, you know, had pictured in their mind. Somewhere, I mean, especially I'd say the agricultural groups and the farmers, they kind of got the life that they were looking for. But if you ended up in a mine, that was probably a different story because just of the difficulty of the day in, day out pressure of that job. So you've got Scotch, Irish, 18th century immigrants coming over, and, you know, without being stereotypical, you know, you've got certain things that characterized that group, such as they were good and used to raising animals. They were good at making whiskey and drinking the whiskey,
mm-hmm.
and having language peculiarities, you know, real specific ways of communicating and talking and thinking. And they brought that culture, especially of storytelling, with them over to the New World and all the other groups that came into West Virginia for the same reason, brought their own specific languages and stories and legends. And so even though by a lot of accounts, like if you had a mining town, for example, and housing was even provided for workers, the people would tend to, as you would imagine, divide themselves up by people group. And you'd stay with your people for the most part, but you would still be daily rubbing shoulders, and literally so, if you're going down into the mines, with people from other ethnic backgrounds. And it was inevitable that there'd be crossover and sharing of stories that would take place, you know, when you were off the job or, you know, during your downtime. And it just became this really rich mix of, you know, everything you can think of that touches folklore, you know, from religious themed stories to just supernatural ghost stories, legends about heroic human figures, and even vampires and werewolves. I mean, just a whole stew of folklore. And that's, I think, still to this day, people consider Appalachia and West Virginia as like the title at the beginning, folklore's natural habitat. And in a, you know, later on in this episode, we'll talk about one woman in particular who was a pioneer in compiling these stories and going after them. And that was kind of the most fascinating part of my research for this particular episode.
Cool. So you can do the actual history, and I'm going to tell stories about spooky banshees and ghosts and stuff, because that's my version of folklore. And apparently one thing I found during the interview we conducted with Susan Shepherd, and Susan has Scotch Irish roots. I can't remember which, but she has that, you know, in her bloodline, but she also has Native American in her bloodline. Mm-hmm. And apparently that's fairly common in that area.
Yeah.
And so you also find that the folklore, and the legends are born out of this strange melding of Native American, you know, cultural stories, and then Celtic, like legends about banshees and like all these kind of things.
Right.
So it's a really unique mix. And when you get into the modern day, at least up through the 20th century, and you start hearing about Mothman, it's not as strange as you would think it would be anywhere else. It's almost, it's almost a part of who Appalachian people are and what their culture is. And especially today, obviously, because that figure has been sort of embraced by the entire state. But one thing, so I mostly suggested this episode because I really wanted, or maybe you suggested it and I just got excited, but I really wanted to talk about banshees, because this was something that I got turned on to when we were conducting interviews for Mothman Legacy, and banshees are going to play a role in Mothman Legacy. But I was fascinated by them because there are surface level similarities between the banshee as a figure and the Mothman. Not necessarily physical descriptions or anything like that, but in the fact that they are said to be a creature or being that appears either to warn of an event or mock someone because of a bad event, or to tell someone that a tragic event has just occurred. And there's also the red eyes. They're said to have red eyes. But in my research for this, I found this really cool story, and I got to read this to you. This is the Banshee of Martown. Are you aware of this at all?
No.
Okay. this is going to take up a little bit of time, so I'm going to have to read this. And it was pulled from the actual Martown website, which Martown is apparently an actual town in, or Mar, I think, is an actual town in West Virginia. And the website is maintained by like a local antique store.
wow.
Yeah. So let me read this to you guys. And then we can move on to something less scary. This is super scary.
Okay.
From the area around the forest of Mar came a family named Mar, whose lives were marked for tragedy. Their trouble began after the family left Scotland to settle down in West Virginia. Scottish immigrant Thomas Mar settled Martown, a small farming community southeast of Parkersburg, in 1836. He married a local woman named Mary Disochet. Mary Mar was an autumn bride considered to be an ill omen. In years to come, Mary would lose 6 of the 8 children that she bore. Only 2 would carry on the Mar name. Times were hard for Thomas and Mary Mar, but they did not lose their dream of a better life. They poured their energies into a simple tract of land that became their home and soon built a picturesque white farmhouse against the shadowy woods thick with sumac, milkweed, and blackberry brambles. The years of the Civil War, as for most, were not happy ones for the Mar family. From their front window, Thomas and Mary witnessed small clashes between Yankee and Confederate soldiers that turned into bloody battles, the Republic hanging on nearby Fort Borman Hill. As the war drew to a close, marauding soldiers from both sides stole freely from the Mars, leaving them destitute. After the Civil War, the Mar family's bad luck appeared to come to an end. Thomas landed a job as a night watchman at the toll bridge that crossed over the Little Kanawha River leading into Martown. Keep note of the bridge. Mary stayed at home to tend the family and the farm. Still, there were ominous hints of what was about to unfold. On several occasions, as Thomas traveled to and from his work, he saw a robed white figure riding a white horse. Thomas claimed he came upon this rider nearly every night, yet he was not able to say much about the figure, as its face was always covered by a tattered hood. As he approached the shrouded figure, the white mare would rear, and horse and rider would disappear into the mists of morning. On a cold February night in the year of 1878, Mary sat by the front window waiting for Thomas to come home from his job. The middle-aged woman heard footsteps coming up the road, so she peered out the window. A white horse walked up to the front gate of the house and stopped. Sitting on the horse was a rider whose face was covered by a ragged veil. Mary walked outside into the frigid night air. The rider remained silent. As bitter winds gusted, Mary Mar pulled her woolen shawl close. She asked the rider what she wanted. There was no answer. Plumes of icy air billowed from the nostrils of the white horse. The decrepit ride sat stiffly in her saddle. Underneath the gauzy veil, Mary saw that a woman's eyes radiated an eerie red glow. After a few moments, the woman on the horse spoke. "I am here to tell you, Mary Mar, that Thomas Mar has just died. Say your prayers, lady. I bid you well." At that, the rider and horse turned abruptly and galloped away. Mary collapsed onto the front step in tears. Within the hour, a man who worked with Thomas came to deliver the news. No one knows for sure what happened to Thomas Mar that fated winter evening. Some say that while working at the toll bridge, Thomas was shot by an assailant's bullet, then fell into the Little Kanawha River and drowned. Others claim that it was the cry of the banshee that startled Thomas into meeting his end in the river below. The truth is, Thomas Mar did die on February 5th, 1878, the day the Martown Banshee visited Mary Mar. Mary Mar lived to be 90 years old, an exception for that time. As Mary lay as a corpse in the parlor of her home many years after her husband's death, family members heard the rattling of chains in the attic. Others claimed to hear the shrieks of a woman. A few years after Mary died, one of the Mar children cut off his hand in a tragic accident. As family members sat up with the boy, they heard snarling sounds on the porch. When the women went outside, the stoop was covered with blood as if a terrible struggle had taken place. What has become of the Banshee of Martown? It is said she still rides, bringing dreaded omens to those of Scottish blood. You would be wise to avoid Martown on dark and moonless nights. Okay, so that's the story, like the folk tale, basically.
Yeah.
Super cool. Some similarities right out of the gate to Mothman in that one.
Sure.
You know, in that it's an omen and red eyes and the bridge, I thought was interesting. And also just the fact that the Little Kanawha River empties into the Ohio River right at Point Pleasant. That's the confluence is Those two rivers right there. But then there's this newspaper story, and I'm not sure what year this ran, and I don't have the name of the writer, which I thought I put it here. And this goes on, so it's a little long. Do you want me to get into this or no? Okay, yeah. This basically corrects the folktale, and it also is an interesting way to sort of point out the discrepancies between what we consider like a folktale and reality. So this was written in a Parkersburg newspaper. Descendants of an area family rumored to be the basis of a haunting by a banshee are casting doubt on the stories. Cynthia Buskirk and Fred Lambert, descendants of Thomas Marr, say documents detailing his death conflict with local lore of the alleged Marrtown banshee that foretold his demise. The story comes up every year at this time, Buskirk said. She and Lambert want to set the record straight regarding the death of Marr. For years, accounts of Marr's death have been embellished and tied to the legend of the Marrtown Banshee. According to legend, Marr, a native of Scotland who settled Marrtown in the 1830s, often saw a robed figure riding a white horse as Marr went to and from work. Marr was never able to make out the figure's face as it was covered by a tattered hood. When he approached the rider, it would disappear into the mist. For days, Marr saw the figure until a cold night in February 1878. This goes into the story, basically, and just retells the legend. According to records and newspaper accounts uncovered by Buskirk, much of the story is untrue. Stories get changed and embellished as they are handed down, Lambert said. Marr was found dead, but he died February 6, 1874. He wasn't shot, nor did he drown. According to the newspaper accounts in the State Journal, the Parkersburg Examiner, Marr was found dead near the platform of the freight depot where he worked. It is believed he had fallen after climbing a top station box to clean out a stovepipe. He fell approximately 10 feet and died the result of a broken neck. He borrowed a stepladder, Buskirk said. It made more sense that he fell off the roof, Buskirk noted. The papers in which she found accounts of Marr's death stated it snowed that day. Marr was close to 60 years old. In addition to uncovering a factual account of Marr's death, Buskirk and Lambert also uncovered facts surrounding Marr and his wife's nationality. Local history claims the pair immigrated from Scotland and settled in Marrtown in 1834. Newspaper accounts of Marr's death list his birth as 1809. Lambert, who has the original Marr family Bible, which is about 200 years old, lists Marr's birth as 1812. Buskirk said census records indicate Marr and his family didn't buy property in the area until 1845. Marr's birthplace and a number of census records is listed as Maryland. His wife Mary Marr's birthplace is in dispute and is listed as Ohio and Vermont, but not Scotland, as stories have told. The Marrs were buried in the Bethel Baptist Church Cemetery in Lubeck. Mart's wife? I don't know who Mart. Oh, Marr's. It's a misprint. Marr's wife Mary, who died at age 90 in 1904, was buried beside him. She didn't get a headstone to mark her grave until the early 1990s. Stories of a more grisly nature of Marr's death have been circulating for more than a half decade. Newspaper reports from the 1950s and a typed history of Marrtown relate the alleged murder of Marr. Some even claim Marr's body was discovered by one of his sons. Buskirk said she stumbled across accounts of Marr's death about three decades ago and has been piecing things together ever since. Buskirk and Lambert don't put much stock in the ghost tales, specifically the Marrtown Banshee. I'm afraid I can't, but Buskirk said. I believe it was embellished. This story would have gone on if I hadn't found the microfilm. So there you go. The Marrtown Banshee killed a man, or maybe she didn't. but I liked the historical setting the record straight on that story, so I thought I'd bring that one to the table.
Yeah. Well, and that's part of a vast genre of folklore, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the whole omen, and there's so many different forms that takes.
Yeah.
Whether it's a banshee or the one that I ran across, a couple of the books that I was looking at, even to continue with the idea of Mothman connections, there was the White Bird of Death,
mm-hmm.
which was, had some obvious crossover there. Also, like a black coach with six fog gray horses. That was kind of an Irish concept of impending doom as well. And there's these involved stories about that. Actually, here's a cool crossover. You have that plus a leprechaun. and the leprechaun can make your house invisible.
Yes.
So that the wagon goes by, it can't find you. So that you get all these cool little crossover folkloric touches where, you know, if you can gain the, gain the favor of a leprechaun, for example, and get them to do your bidding, you can actually thwart death, if only for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I really like the modern explanation to the folklore. I think that too is kind of the edge of where folklore leads up to a sort of a modern, sober, scientific explanation of it.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that I think is always going to just exist. You know, it's sort of it's the way modern folklore happens, you know, as it puts it in a modern context where, you know, we believe more in reporters and media and stuff than we do a white bird that's going to fly against our window or a banshee that's going to come up on the porch. But mm-hmm. It just seems like that's always moving forward, you know, sort of that line of where, how far do we take folklore from a fun story into something that might actually be describing something that's real. And mm-hmm. that's the fascination of folklore, I think.
Yeah.
That's cool.
It is. And what I love about it is it's got those cultural roots. Like it's so rooted in generations telling stories over and over again.
Yeah.
And I mean, you're going to see as soon as I start sending you pieces of the Mothman Legacy narration to work on that's a huge theme of the movie mm-hmm. is the retelling of, I mean, obviously we've been dancing around these storytelling, you know, sub themes or themes in our films for a while now, but this one really dives into like how a story can create something, an emotion in someone, mm-hmm. fear or whatever. And a lot of that is because of how rooted in its history West Virginia is. Like how much history is there? It's funny because it was settled later than a lot of areas around it because of the fact that everyone avoided it up through the 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that is true, some of it isn't, but there are definitely parts of West Virginia that everyone avoided, even the Native Americans at the time avoided,
mm-hmm.
which is really fascinating as well. I had stories I had written down here that I wanted to get into, but as we're talking about all of this, first of all, we're already 35 minutes into the episode, but also a couple of these I don't think fit into this episode. So maybe we're going to do a Monsters of West Virginia, because I have a couple Monongahela. How do you say that stupid river?
Yeah.
Monongahela. I have a couple of river monsters that relate to that.
Oh yeah.
That river that I really want to get into, but it doesn't necessarily fit in this episode. So maybe we can do an episode that focuses more on sort of like general monsters next or after we hit the Bigfoot episode. But one thing I did want to talk about real quick, and this leads me into another story I've never told you and you don't know about that we have to get to at some point on Monsteropolis. And that is the Fae. So something cool that I found out in some of my research is that pretty much every nationality that settled in the state of West Virginia had some sort of belief relating to the Fae, including the Native Americans who had stories about tiny people in the woods and theirs weren't necessarily winged and flying around. They were more like dwarves, but there were a lot of similarities between what the Native Americans believed regarding tiny folk and what like the Scotch Irish were talking about with fairies. And I found a really cool article called Finding Fairies in Marion County by Rachel Ellis. I don't know that I want to read this whole thing because it's pretty long, but the strongest beliefs we know of, music said, were from the Scotch Irish who came to the county to work the mines and farm the fields. Music said that while these fairy believing folk had plenty of foundations for their tales in Ireland, where ratted ruins and ancient tunnels are so common you could trip over them, fairy dwellings may have been scarce in the hills of Marion County. It goes into this whole thing about fairies that's super interesting and relates back to the Irish and the Scotch Irish, and I think it's so cool. And we might have to do a Fae episode. And the reason I say this is because Adrian has a Fae story, as strange as this might seem. And it is entirely corroborated by her mother.
Really?
They were together and saw a fairy, and they will both 100% tell you that's what they saw.
Wow.
So I didn't know this until a couple of weeks ago, maybe not even that long ago. It might've been last week.
Kidding.
Wow. Adrian told me this story, and it's like, it involves her, an old house. And she was, this wasn't even that long ago, man. This is like in the last 10 years. And her and her mom both saw this thing and watched it and took photos of it. And it was in their garage for a while. So,
have you seen the photos?
The photos should exist somewhere. They're on an old flip phone, I think, is the problem. And so she says they're terrible, but they should be somewhere, I would think.
Wow.
But
that's unbelievable.
Yeah. And I said, you know, like, we're going to have to do a Fae episode and then get her and her mom on the show so we can talk about this.
Yeah,
it's super interesting.
Now, in that article that you were referencing now, did that refer to Dr. Ruth Ann Music?
Yes.
See, she is the kind of the central figure of the 20th century compilation of folklore in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, she deserves an episode as well because of her work being so influential.
Oh, you know what?
In this whole pursuit.
This was actually Pat Music, interim director at the Folk Life Center. So maybe it's a relative.
It must be a relative because Ruth Ann Music served at Fairmont State University. And to this day, I mean, there's a folklore festival annually that has her name attached to it. The library at Fairmont State is named after her. And her books are just extremely influential, not just for West Virginia, but like folklore in general. And this was all new to me. This is part of the fascination research for me, is just learning stuff like this. And she has books. Of course, we can't get into it right now, but I would, if people are really interested in this topic, I would really suggest they pick up two books. The Telltale Lilac Bush is her first one. And then the one that I picked up for today was called Green Hills of Magic, West Virginia Folktales from Europe. And those are Ruth Ann Music, M-U-S-I-C-K. And the thing that I wanted to make sure to share with you is that, you know, how you're talking about one of the sub-themes of Mothman Legacy is like the sharing of stories, handing them down. In the, like, there's a small appendix section of Green Hills of Magic where Ruth Ann Music takes, you know, introduces you to the people who the stories came from. So it's not just a compilation of stories, but it tells you who got the story from whom, you know, in many cases it's their grandparents or great grandparents and what their ethnic background was. And it's just, it traces that whole history for
That's
you,
awesome.
Which is just really amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I love this topic, and I think I love it because I love the state so much. Sincerely, like I'd kind of like to, kind of like to do the same thing with Ohio and maybe some other states as well, is really dive into like where the folklore originated from. Cause in West Virginia, it's so tied into that Irish and Scotch heritage. A lot of it. And
yeah,
I think that's so fascinating. And it just puts everything in a whole new light. When you get to the present day or even the 60s and you start seeing things like the Flatwoods Monster and the Mothman, you realize it's born. I mean, it's not necessarily, this isn't to write off the actual eyewitness stories, but it's a part of that state. It's already a part of the history. It's putting a new face on something that has been there for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
I think that's so interesting.
It is. And like you said before, I mean, that plus Native American legend. And attached to that as well are the later waves of immigrants that also settled in that area, which include like Germanic people and Italian as well.
Yeah.
So you've got this great stew of story being sort of the background and the context for these modern cases. And I agree completely. It's not to explain away or to say that this equals that in the modern era, but all of this story exists as the backdrop for what's going on now.
Yeah.
And I think that's just from a storytelling standpoint, it's fascinating to see how, you know, that like the genres of stories, the subgroups or the motifs, as they're sometimes called, that's something else that music does in some of her books is in the back. There's a whole method that folklorists to categorize stories. Mm-hmm. And that's just kind of a cool little nerdy extra thing, but to look at how these stories are created by like intuitions, bad choices, you know, impending death. It just and how these just seem to be natural across people groups. You know, no matter where you come from, your people have been telling stories like this.
Mm-hmm.
And just to see the lessons that they kind of carry with them is also pretty illuminating.
Yeah. Yeah, super, super fun. And I'm really excited to get into this somewhat visually with the movie, because there's going to be a lot of really cool visual representations of this folklore in Mothman Legacy as well.
Nice.
Do you want to add anything to wrap this up? I mean, obviously, we barely touched the surface here, but...
Yeah, I mean, we're scratching the surface for sure, but I think it's an exciting intro into a much deeper topic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we'll, you know, where we go from here is just maybe a little bit more into, like you said, the connection between folklore and monster reports and cryptids, because there's similarities, but also distinctions and differences. But you can't help it. Like in Music's first book, The Telltale Lilac Bush, she couldn't help but have one chapter that was devoted to creature stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, the overlap between those two is something, it's a fun place to...
Yeah. Awesome. If you want to leave us a rating and review on iTunes, that would be wonderful. You can send us mail to monsteropolismail@gmail.com. If you'd like to suggest someone you would like to hear us interview on our bonus episodes, feel free to do that. I think that's it for this week. We'll be back on Tuesday of next week with a Stan Gordon interview. And then again the following Friday, or next Friday, for another episode of this, of Mark and I talking to each other. So that's it. Take care. Be safe. Stay healthy.
Yeah. Be well.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. Be well.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com, and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.